simply go ahead and ask you the questions?
Yes.
All right, first would be perhaps the best place to begin, maybe at the beginning. Would you discuss your own selection for the court, or at least what you know about it? How was it that the president chose you? When did you first know that you were being considered? Who told you? At what stage did the president personally inform you of his intentions? Did you have any preliminary discussion with him about the matter? Or do you know if any member or members of the court joined in recommending you? Did you have any fears about Senate confirmation?
Well, what I knew about my appointment to the court, I learned largely after the appointment had been made. I had never had any idea of being a judge. It never entered into any of my calculations. I never even thought of it as a remote possibility, either being on that court or any other court. I had been in 1939 elected as dean of the Yale Law School, and I was going to leave Washington that June to take over the deanship of the school at Yale. And I had told Roosevelt that in, I think, January of 1939. I'd been in Washington with him nearly 5 years. We were very close. I had worked with him on many of his speeches. I spent at least one weekend, month with him. Saw him on many social occasions. Was very, very close to him. But we never had talked about the court. He had never talked to me before the court plan was announced in 1937. I didn't know anything about it until I read it in the papers. None of the problems of the court had had been discussed, or the personnel. Brandeis retired, I believe it was February, or maybe it was early March. I believe it was February 1939. I learned later that from Brandeis that he had gone to the president and had urged the president to name me as Brandeis' successor. Brandeis and I had been very close. I had known him that before I went to Washington in 1934. I was very close to him during those years, between 1934 and 1939. He was particularly interested in me, I think, because I was continuing some of the things that he had undertaken in his earlier years. He was very active in investigating financial markets, the machinations of stock market manipulators, and so on, many of which appeared in his writings, including other people's money. And I was in the midst of the stock exchange problem, the Wall Street problem, the problem of the security offerings, and so on. And I used to see him practically every week. He had an avid interest in the work that was going on and the details as to what was happening and so on. I had actually received sort of a commission from Brandeis to sometime after I'd returned to Yale to take up the story of the New Haven Railroad and the story of its financial disasters.
You mean a story from where he left off?
A story from where he left off. I mention that because Brandeis and I had been very, very close, but he never mentioned to me that he, until after Roosevelt named me to the court, that he had recommended it. Actually, the Roosevelt had decided upon another man. The man was Schwellenbach, Louis Schwellenbach, who was senator from the state of Washington. Justice Black, Hugo L. Black, he and Schwellenbach had been very close. They'd been associated in committee work, and Black thought very, very highly of him. Black had been on the court since the summer, I think, of 1937, and he was anxious for some ideological allies, I think. And his candidate was Schwellenbach, and Roosevelt actually had decided to name Schwellenbach. Roosevelt had called Frank Murphy, who was the Attorney General, to the White House and said that he had decided on Schwellenbach and he thought he'd send up his name. For some reason that I never learned, Murphy said, would you mind waiting a while, Mr. President? Is there any great rush about this? And Roosevelt said, no, there's no great rush about it. You have something else in mind? Well, he said, maybe I might have some other suggestions to make to you. And Roosevelt said, rather casually, sure, take your time. There's no rush about it. Why Murphy did that, I don't know. There was developing in the West a great opposition to Schwellenbach from the state of Washington. Schwellenbach had been in very bitter feuds with Homer Bone, who was his companion senator from the state of Washington, the senior senator. He'd been in very bitter encounters with Saul Hass, who at that time was the manager of the Bone forces and sort of the Democratic leader, political leader of the state of Washington. And they'd had many feuds. What was behind it all, I never knew, because Schwellenbach and I were always very friendly. Perhaps Bone and Hass, Bobby La Follette, that I'll mention in a minute, perhaps some of them had something to do with getting from Roosevelt an agreement to hold off the nomination of Schwellenbach. In any event, shortly after that, the people in the state of Washington began to become very, very active, the opponents of Schwellenbach, the political opponents of Schwellenbach. Saul Hass, I know, arranged for the Tacoma Bar Association, the Seattle Bar Association, the Spokane Bar Association, the State Bar Association, various individual judges and lawyers to send telegrams to Roosevelt against that appointment. And then, to my very great surprise, I heard that he and Bone and some of my other friends were suggesting my name to Roosevelt in lieu of Schwellenbach's. One night at a reception in Georgetown, Arthur Kroc of the New York Times got me aside and said that on the front page of tomorrow's New York Times, there will appear in a box a story that he said, I made it up myself. I have no basis for it, but I think it may start something, and that is that from a confidential White House source, I learned that the next appointee to the Supreme Court is going to be yourself. I thought this was all a joke because Roosevelt had publicly announced that he was going to choose a man from the Far West. And I had grown up in the Far West, gone to school in the Far West. I'd practiced law very briefly in the Far West in 1927 before coming back to Columbia to join the faculty. And after Columbia, I'd gone to Yale, and at New Haven, I had registered as a voter, and I was one of three that ran the senatorial campaign that took Francis Maloney to the United States Senate from Connecticut. And I was, at that time, in 1939, a registered voter in Connecticut. I'd never been a member of the Connecticut Bar, but that was my legal home and residence, so I discounted these stories very much that Roosevelt was going to name me. As a matter of fact, I thought it was all a great joke. The forces behind Lew Schwalenbach were also very active. And finally, someone, how this happened, I don't know. But they got William E. Borah, who at that time, I believe, was not chairman of the... he was ranking member of the Judiciary Committee.
Ranking minority member.
Yes, I think of the Senate Judiciary Committee. A very powerful Republican, man that I knew very, very slightly. I knew him by reputation. He had been one of my great heroes as a boy. Borah, in his later years, was pretty much of a conservative in many respects. I remember the night before he died, I spent the evening with him. He thought that the war that was going on in Europe was a phony war, and he talked to me at great length about it. He was a man that knew very, very, very little about the world and the forces that were shaping up around the world. But he'd been a great, fearless, independent politician in Idaho. And I remember as a boy hearing about Borah, who got an engineer to appropriate a locomotive engine and race from Boise, Idaho, down to Nampa, I think, where a Negro was about to be lynched. And Borah in front of the jail, getting up on a soapbox and in less than an hour, convincing the crowd that they were on the wrong side of justice and saving the life of the Negro. This man was a great heroic figure. But as I say, I hardly knew him, and by the time 1939 had arrived, he was getting more and more conservative, as many people do in their later years. But somebody, whether it was Homer Bone or Saul Hass, I don't know. Maybe it might have been Bobby La Follette, brought Borah into the picture. They arranged for Borah to have a press conference, and they arranged for, they told Borah, I learned later, what questions were going to be asked and who was going to ask them, and they primed these reporters to ask a series of questions. And one of them was, did the senator know me? And he said he did. And the other question was, what did he think of me? And he went on with very flattering statements about me. Would he think that I was qualified to be a member of the Supreme Court? He said he thought I was eminently qualified. And he went on to talk about my so-called qualifications for the post of Supreme Court Justice. Then somebody asked him the $64 question. The president, as President Roosevelt, is looking for a man from the far west. Would you consider Bill Douglas, as a reporter put it, a representative of the far west? And Barr then became very eloquent, saying he not only represents Washington, but he represents Idaho and Montana and Oregon. He is our native son. And we all look to him as our representative. Well, that was in the headlines in the Washington papers the next morning. And the following Sunday, I think it was, I was out playing golf, and the messenger came out saying that I was the president wanted to see me. And so I dressed and went down to the White House. He was in the Oval Room. I told him that I was going to go to Yale to become dean of the law school. And I figured that he had some new job for me. It didn't occur to me that he was going to offer me the post of Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. At that time, the Federal Communications Commission was in great difficulty, almost as great a difficulty as it was in under Eisenhower. The chairman, who had just resigned, was a man by the name of, McMinch. The place was in great disorder, and Roosevelt had thought I had done an outstanding job at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and I was sure that he was going to draft me for the chairmanship of the Federal Communications Commission, which would be about the last job in Washington that I would want. And I was trying to figure, as I drove to the White House, how I would get out of the draft. And when I was ushered into the Oval Room, where he was sitting alone, he greeted me in his customarily handsome way and said he had a new job for me, and I told him I had figured that much out. And he said, "You know what it is?" And I said, "I think I do." He says, "It's the job you won't like." And I said, I know that." He says, "It's the most disagreeable job in town, probably." And I said, I agree with him. And so he led me on for about 5 minutes. And finally, he said, all joking aside, he said, "I'm sending your name up to the Supreme Court tomorrow morning." It was a very great surprise to me. Because, as I say, I'd never even dreamed of that kind of a career in the law. And the name did go up the next day, and the I was confirmed shortly afterwards, and I think I took my seat on the... This conversation with Roosevelt took place sometime in March 1939. I think my name went to the Senate on the 20th of March, and I think I took my seat on the 17th of April. I think that's approximately the chronology.
Right. Did you were you in any way worried about Senate confirmation once you had been informed that the nomination had been made?
I didn't. I knew that that Barr, with his strong position on the Republican side, was for me. And so I had no worries there. And Frank Maloney from Connecticut, one of my dearest and closest friends, was very enthusiastic about my appointment on the Democratic side. And I should say that when Roosevelt named me, he didn't name me from the state of Washington, but he stuck strictly to the record and named me from Connecticut, where I was in residence. And the Connecticut delegation, of course, was behind me. There was a lot of support from the West, as I said, and I had no doubts or misgivings. It never occurred to me. I was received a telephone call shortly after the name went to the Senate, saying that they wanted a hearing, which is customary, before the Judiciary Committee. And I went over and appeared. It was a short, rather perfunctory hearing. As I remember, Barr was there, and Senator Omani of Wyoming was there. The hearing lasted just a few minutes. And a little while later, the nominations report out to the floor, and I got a telephone call from Maloney saying that there was trouble brewing on the floor. And he said that he thought that he and La Follette could handle it, but it might acquire serious proportions. And I asked him what was behind that, and he said it comes largely from Burton K. Wheeler, and a man that is in Wheeler's office by the name of Lowenthal. Lowenthal was a man who had written a book about the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific Railroad reorganization. He had collaborated in the book with the wife of Felix Frankfurter, Marion Frankfurter. Lowenthal I had known him when I was running an investigation at the SEC from 1934 through 1935. I had gone to Lowenthal to get help in selecting a staff. He recommended a fine man that I'd taken. And while the investigation was pretty well underway, Lowenthal came to me one day and said that he thought that the man who could help me most was his partner in the New York law firm. He described his partner in glowing terms, as if he was somewhat of a combination between Jesus Christ and Oliver Wendell Holmes. So, in such glowing terms, I was immediately suspicious. So I asked my investigative staff if they'd run across this man in any of their investigations, and they said they had. So instead of hiring him as a consultant, we moved in and investigated this man's reorganizations, and he turned out to be one of the least reputable people in the street, as far as reorganizations went. A man who was engaging in very questionable activities. And the fact that I put Lowenthal's partner on the stand and held him there for a couple of days, taking all the gold fillings out of his teeth, made me lose the friendship of Lowenthal, but that was only part of it. When I was making this investigation for the SEC of protective committees and reorganizations, we got into the foreign bondholders field, and we got into the Cuban bond situation. At that time, Bert Wheeler of Montana was, I think, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And while he was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, he had received a secret fee of $50,000 to represent the Cuban bondholders before the government of Cuba, a highly unethical transaction by our standards of that day. And in the Cuban bondholder investigation and hearing, Bert Wheeler, whom I knew fairly well, had heard that we'd come across this, and he summoned the Democratic stalwarts in the party to try to put pressure on to keep that fact from being disclosed. But as I told the Jim Farley and some of the others in the Democratic organization, that this was not a political investigation. This was across the boards, and we were bringing out everything that we ran across that was relevant. And so it was produced at a hearing that Bert Wheeler had received this $50,000 fee when he was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And Bert Wheeler never forgave me for that. So Bert Wheeler and Lowenthal both had axes to grind, and they ground their axes when my nomination came to the floor. They had Lowenthal was writing the speeches against my nomination, and the man who was delivering the papers that Lowenthal was writing was a senator that I did not know from North Dakota by the name of Fraser. And he had to read very slowly because Lowenthal was just one page ahead of him on the typewriter. And Bert Wheeler at that time had been very closely associated with some of the labor people like John Lewis, and he had tried to get John Lewis to get the mine workers to telegraph or write their senators to stop this appointment. But all of that didn't add up to very much. The final vote, I think they were three or four voted against me. I forget the exact number. One of them was Fraser. Wheeler didn't. Wheeler absented himself, although he was in the city. He stayed in his office and didn't vote. And the others voted against me. I forget. One was Cabot Lodge, and I forget the others. But it was largely a little storm in a teapot. Didn't amount to anything.
I don't know. Should we go on to the next question? Excuse me one second. Well, for a second question, we have here something that skips on to your first years on the court. When he was an associate justice, Harlan Stone was quite critical of the way that Chief Justice Hughes conducted the conference. Hughes, Stone felt, dominated the conference, cut short discussion, and squelched much potentially meaningful exchange of ideas among the justices. To what extent
does your experience under Hughes's chief justiceship confirm or contradict Stone's views? Now, perhaps it would help if you would summarize your own recollections about the procedures Hughes followed in conducting the conference.
Well, I might say to begin with that the Stone was my first professor when I went to law school at Columbia. He gave the first year course in personal property, and I got to know him then. And when I went to Washington with the SEC, I saw quite a lot of Stone, who was then on the court. And Stone and I were very close. It was a sort of a continuation of the student-professor relationship from the earlier years. So I got to know Stone intimately, spent many, many hours with him in his home. Hughes and Stone never got along. What was behind it all, I don't know.
After Taft's death, and that he was making a call to Hughes just as a perfunctory matter, thinking that Hughes would turn him down. Do you think possibly that Stone believed this story?
I don't know. I never talked to Stone about that. I think that story was true, and that Hoover was surprised when Hughes accepted. Whether that was the irritant between Stone and Hughes, I just simply don't know. Stone thought that the conferences were much, much too short. He had no chance to discuss matters in conference that he'd like to discuss. As a result, what Stone did was to have a sort of a rump conference Friday after court. In those days, we sat 2 weeks and recessed 2 weeks, but during the 2 weeks of sitting, we sat from 12 to 2 and 2:30 to 4:30, 5 days a week, and had our conference on Saturday. And our conferences on Saturday then started at 12 o'clock instead of 10 as they do now, which is the year 1961. And they always ended at 4:30. And during that period from 12 to 4:30, we had a half hour out for lunch. So that meant that in a 4 hour period, we would go over as many, all the cases that had been argued. And there were many more cases being argued each week then than there has been in the 50s and in the this early part of the 60s. And there were almost as many important cases on the certiorari list and the list of appeals. Hughes covered all those in a very, very efficient way. One of the reasons that he did that was, first, he had tremendous capacity, an unusual capacity to get things done very fast. For example, he would come into conference, maybe we'd have 6, 7, 8, 10 jurisdictional statements, which covering appeals from state courts or from the Interstate Commerce Commission, once in a while from a court of appeals in the federal system. And for each of those, there usually was a motion to affirm or to dismiss. Hughes usually at the conference said, "Brethren, in this appeal, such and such a number, such and such a name, I suggest that we grant the motion to affirm or grant the motion to dismiss and cite the following cases. And he would have, he come into conference prepared with those citations, and his vote would usually carry the day. On the argued cases, he was very crisp and short and succinct, opening the discussion, stating his reasons in a very short summary way, dismissing maybe six or seven points, saying they're collateral and the man who writes the opinion can take care of them. The only really important issue in the case is this one, numbered one or five or whatever it was. And he would give his view in just a sentence or two sometimes, or maybe a minute or two at other times, and then lean back and say, Mr. Justice McReynolds, who's the next senior judge. And McReynolds would say something short, or usually short or a little longer. Whatever McReynolds said, as soon as he'd finished, Hughes would very quickly call on the next senior, who at that time was, Butler, and then very quickly go on to the next one, and so on. There would be no rejoinder on Hughes's part, whether the man agreed with him or disagreed with him. And then as soon as the last man had spoken, he said, now we'll vote, and he'd open the docket book to the sheet. Well, this case was listed, and starting with the junior judge, he would call for a vote. This was very fast, very expeditious, very summary. And Stone thought that the cases were not being adequately considered. And so I was invited by Stone to come out to his house. Stone had a house up on
Wyoming,
24th Street, I think, that he built specially for his particular needs. And in that house, he had one side that was a great big study, where he had his secretary and his law clerk, and a big library. And we'd sit around there. I say we, those who were invited, three or four or five would sit around, and Stone would act as the presiding officer and discuss each case and each point, and the thing went on and on and on. Then we'd go into conference. This was the next day. The people who were invited out there by Stone were Disherton, myself, Roberts, Frankfurter, Reed. I don't think he ever invited Black. He didn't like Black. Stone didn't trust Black. Stone, I think, thought very poorly of Black. Stone used to go for early morning walks, and he talked very freely to the press about his colleagues. He gave one interview to Marcus Childs about Black. I don't think Stone was identified in the Marcus Child article as the source, but Stone was the source, and it was not exactly a libelous thing, but it was a very distorted, cruel caricature of a very able, brilliant man. Whether that was the reason that Stone and Black were not close, I don't know. I think it was
I can say from going through the Stone papers that Stone himself bitterly regretted having said that about Black.
Perhaps in his later years, but during these earlier times, when I first went on the court, Stone was always saying rather uncomplimentary things in private conversations about Brother Black and so on. Well, anyway, we'd go up to Stone's place and sit around and discuss these cases, then come back into conference. On the Saturday, under Hughes, we'd always be through at 4:30. I said there were several reasons why Hughes got through at 4:30. One was he was terribly efficient. He could do in 4 hours what would take the average man 8 hours to do. He had a photographic mind. He'd take a group of papers, legal cap size, and you'd think he was just turning the pages, counting them, but actually he was reading. And he could absorb very quickly what was in front of him. But the other reason why he got through at 4:30 was because he was dealing with an old court. Brandeis had a principle that he never would sit after 4:30. Brandeis, by the way, was a Spartan in some respects. I believe he was one of the first, if not the first, member of the Boston Bar who never went to his office on Saturday. This was way back, last century. He thought that 5 days was enough. The thing that motivated Brandeis in that regard, I think, was one, not that he was lazy, because he wasn't. Not that he didn't like to work, he did enjoy it. He had the view that fatigue is man's greatest enemy when it comes to judgment. And the tired man, frustrated man, worried man don't make good decisions. So Brandeis, all of his life was on most of his professional life was on a 5-day week. Whenever he could, when he came to court, of course, he had to work on Saturdays, but he cut that down to 4:30, and while I wasn't there, when Brandeis was there, since I took his place on the court, the stories around the court were that at 4:30, he would, if Hughes hadn't finished, he would stand up and say, "I'm sorry, Chief Justice, but I must go, and I'll leave my vote." And if Hughes hadn't finished, he would finish very quickly.